Everybody knows the deal is rotten. Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows the war is over. Everybody knows the good guys lost. Everybody knows the fight was fixed. The poor stay poor, the rich get rich. That's how it goes.
Welcome to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm with you tonight. I'm Allison Rose Levy, substituting for Carolyn Baker, who's at a wonderful Age of Limits conference this weekend. Happy Memorial Day weekend, listeners. We have a terrific show for you tonight. I'm a health, food, and environmental journalist and regularly host the program Connect the Dots here on PRN. And I'm delighted to be with you tonight on the Lifeboat Hour, a wonderful program that I've long admired. And it's just an incredible honor. And I hope you'll enjoy tonight's show. We're going to be discussing something that I think is one of the most crucial new initiatives that's going on that people need to learn about, get involved in stopping, and we're going to talk to a leading legal expert on it on tonight's show. Our topic is the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the TPP, and you're going to learn a whole lot about it, what it's doing, and why it should be stopped from our guest tonight, David S. Levine. He's an associate professor of law at Elon University School of Law and an affiliate scholar at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. He has a whole bunch of initiatives. He even has his own radio program called Hearsay Culture on KZSU-FM at Stanford University. And he's been testifying and present at negotiations for several rounds of the Trans-Pacific Partnership Agreement. And you're going to find out more about that tonight here on the Lifeboat Hour. So let me welcome our guest. Welcome to you, David Levine.
Allison, thank you for having me on tonight. It's a pleasure to be here.
So, you know, some of our listeners may not be familiar with the TPP, David. And in fact, when I go around and talk about it with people, I'm frequently surprised at how few people are aware that this major life-changing, world-changing trade agreement is, you know, has been proposed, is in the offing, and so few people realize what it is, what it does, and why it must be stopped. Can you give our listeners here tonight on the Lifeboat Hour just a basic introductory primer on the TPP?
Sure. So the TPP is a multilateral trade agreement that's been negotiated largely, depending on your perspective, almost exclusively in secret for about, at this point, three to four years. It stands, as you mentioned, for a Trans-Pacific Partnership, and it's an agreement that the United States is negotiating with about 12 countries, and it runs the range of issues from traditional trade topics, like, for example, tobacco trade, to less traditional topics, and the reason why I got involved in the issue, issues involving intellectual property law, and technology law, and the like. And so it's styled as a trade agreement, meaning that, as the Obama administration has explained it, it's an agreement that's designed to modernize trade policy and harmonize, ultimately, law among existing trading partners. So the U.S. is negotiating with traditional trading allies like Australia and New Zealand, and less traditional emerging markets like Malaysia and Singapore, as well as longer standing Asian trading partners like Japan. Mexico has joined, and so there's a number of countries, but it's a very complex and also extremely wide ranging agreement.
So at the face of it, you know, a trade agreement is kind of a trade agreement. And why would we here on the Lifeboat Hour be interested in those sort of minor details of trade, you know, but there's something else going on here, isn't there? Isn't that so, David?
Yeah, so, yeah, I mean, that what I gave you is kind of the overarching standard definition if I had 2 minutes.
Right.
But yeah, I mean, Allison, you raise a, you know, good question, which is why should the listeners to this show be interested in it? And this is, and I recognize I have an hour here, but I'm not going to dominate a full hour on this, although quite frankly, this answer could go on for a while. So let me give you kind of the shorter version, and then we can dig deeper if you'd like. You know,
sure.
Trade agreements traditionally, as I mentioned, involve topics that were fairly narrow in terms of the interest groups and interests involved. So what do I mean? You know, if you're talking about trade of tobacco between the United States and another country, there's a fairly, you know, limited range of interest from the public and elsewhere on that topic, right? Generally, I mean, putting aside health issues involving tobacco, of course, but assuming that you're going to trade in that commodity, right? Two countries are deciding how much should go between those countries, should there be tariffs, and so forth. More recently, trade agreements have become extremely wide-ranging and covering a number of topics, as I mentioned a moment ago, that are not traditionally trade topics. So what do I mean? In the TPP, there is a chapter involving intellectual property. Now, again, recognizing that this is not a topic that comes up regularly on this show, you know, intellectual property, for those that aren't familiar much, right, covers four broad areas of law: copyright, trademark, trade secrecy, and patents. So with copyright, for example, you've got issues involving things like piracy, right? What the entertainment industry calls piracy in the law is called infringement, right? So someone taking a copyrighted work, taking a piece of music, and copying it and distributing it without authorization of the copyright owner, right? That's piracy. That's a significant issue for the entertainment industry. It's a significant issue for the copyright industry generally. And the question has become, more recently with the advent of the Internet, right, what the law should do to respond to that kind of infringement, okay? Copyright law is in a variety of countries. In the U.S., it is federal law. And there's very clear law with regard to what is or is not infringement. And so some of your listeners may have heard of the doctrine called fair use. Fair use is effectively, and I'm going to make this, this is my short answer, by the way, but I'm getting to the point here quickly. Fair use is a defense to copyright infringement, meaning, right, if you use a copyrighted work a certain way, like, for example, to critique it, right, to analyze it, to build upon it, and so forth, copyright law says, well, that is okay, right? I'm making it very simple. Enter TPP. Right, enter TPP. Some of your listeners may be familiar with the battle that occurred a few years ago involving the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA. And this, by way of disclosure, was a bill that I was heavily involved in advocating against. I co-authored a letter with Mark Lemley at Stanford Law School and David Post at Temple, where we outlined three broad concerns with regard to SOPA and PIPA, and I will say, without hesitation, that I was very pleased to see when it was killed. SOPA and PIPA is a response to piracy, which would have amplified penalties, created easier ways for people to be brought into courts, and so forth. Okay? SOPA and PIPA, while it has been defeated in the United States, has perhaps emerged to some degree in TPP. In other words, right, TPP has taken up, in a sense, where Congress failed to act. Okay, now one of the issues involving this, and you know, cut me off at any point. One of the issues which is very important here to recognize why this is something that people should pay attention to, is that what effectively can happen in a trade agreement, and I'm going to start putting that word, that phrase in quotes, a trade agreement, is if the United States agrees that copyright law should look like X or Y, right? So copyright law should allow for actions in courts involving infringement for linking to allegedly infringing works. What do I mean? Someone has a hyperlink on a web page to another page that has alleged copyright infringing works. The person with that link on their page could be sued, okay? Trade agreements if they include that kind of language, could require the countries that sign on to those agreements to literally change their laws, okay? Meaning, right, in order to comply with the agreement, they have to change their law to match, okay, whatever it is that the agreement says. And what has happened through trade agreements is that, and now I'm going to answer this part, this non-traditional area of intellectual property is now being moved through international trade agreements in ways that are potentially very dangerous because, right, and here's the kicker, we as the public do not know what, in fact, is being negotiated. As it stands right now, right, and
okay,
we're recording
just,
the show
just,
on May...
Let's pause a second there for a thought. So on the one hand, what you're saying is that this is putting in, I just want to get this in like kind of two separate thoughts for our listeners.
Sure. Mm-hmm.
So on the one hand, what you're saying is that laws are being put in that mean that this trade agreement is changing American law. So, you know, in other words, we would be in a position then as Americans having to conform to what these international trade treaties have agreed to with these multinational companies. And that means that whatever local laws we might have passed or not passed suddenly come into play by virtue of these trade agreements that we didn't vote into law and we didn't, you know, elect to have, in that we would have to harmonize with them. I just want to make sure I get that point correct. Is that accurate? You gave one example in terms of copyright, but that's, my understanding is that's also true in a range of other things. This supersedes potentially American law. Is that correct?
Yes, that's correct. So in order, assuming that this agreement was ultimately executed, right, and mm-hmm. that is far from clear as it stands now, right, mm-hmm. the U.S. and all the signatory countries would be required to harmonize their laws. So for example, just to give you another example, and again, the secrecy aspect of this is something that's extremely important that we want to get
to. We'll totally get to that, but I just want
right.
to keep, the two pieces of
it clear for our listeners.
Yeah,
so
yeah.
to be clear, right, if you want to talk about, you know, the substance, right, again, recognizing that we, as we sit here and talk today, we do not, the public, have access to the actual negotiating text beyond leaks, which at this point are dated, right, but by way of one example, right, from what we think we know. Right.
Okay, let me just get that clear. You're saying the second point that you're making here is not only that this would supersede our law with these what's ever agreed to in the treaties, but the other part of it is we don't even know what they're voting on and what is the substance of what they're agreeing to as they may be voting in the TPP. So, if it got voted in, it could supersede, and B, as this is being on the table, there is no transparency as to what is being determined and put into those treaties. Is that the second point you're making? Is that correct?
That's generally true. The one mm-hmm. important thing to remember, of course, is that the negotiators themselves aren't voting, right? The negotiators mm-hmm. are coming to a text, right? And then
mm-hmm.
that text, because it's a trade agreement, would have to move through the legislative arena, right? So it would have to move through, and this is part of this issue, which some of your listeners may be familiar with, and again, this sounds very arcane procedurally, right, but fast-track authority is something the Obama administration has sought to move TPP, assuming it got that far, through Congress with basically an expedited review process. But
mm-hmm.
what it effectively means, right, to get to that and to underscore your second mm-hmm. point, is that by the time an agreement came out of the negotiations, the political process being what it is, it would be extremely unlikely, if not impossible, for that agreement to change much, right? And so the opportunity that the public would have to actually impact the text would be happening during the negotiations, which, as I indicated, are not public. And so, for example, on the substance, again, sticking with the substance of it, right, another copyright example, you've got under the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, you've got a ban on technologies, right, that are used to prevent unlawful copying. But what winds up happening, we think through the TPP, for example, is that if someone wanted to get around those digital locks in order to take a copyrighted work and make something new. So let me make this clear, right? Take someone like Robert Greenwald, right? Who, and, you know, the documentary filmmaker that many of your listeners may be familiar with, who's done documentaries on Walmart and what have, right? If Robert Greenwald, and I'm using this by way of a hypothetical example, right? Robert Greenwald wants to access a copyrighted work, right? And in order to do so, he needs to get around technology that prevents a copy in order to create a fair use protected work, right? Something that copyright law says is okay, right? Under TPP, okay, based upon, again, the killer thing being what we know, right? Making an otherwise lawful copy to exercise fair use rights could wind up being actionable, right? So it winds up being a way for copyright owners to prevent fair uses, okay? And it goes on and on from there, because I've mentioned copyright, but there's issues involving patentability and access to generic medicines, which, of course, is a critical issue in countries where people are not earning the income to pay for expensive patent-protected drugs. And so it goes down the list from there, increasing penalties. But all of these substantive issues, getting back to your first question, are not traditional topics of trade agreements. They are not traditionally the kinds of topics that trade negotiators get into. They are much broader. These are much broader issues that, at least I have argued, are not really issues that should be run through the trade system.
And isn't it also true that there are certain provisions, for example, that if there are laws that localities or countries enact, for example, to protect health or protect the environment, or, you know, protect anything that they choose to, that because of these trade agreements, some of the international trading partners could come in and say, your local law is preventing my future income, or is preventing me from developing something, whether drilling for gas or selling GMO foods or selling my product. You are blocking my, your law, which says, you know, this is unhealthy, we don't use this kind of substance in a food or whatever it might be. If that can be said by a company to block their potential for trade, they could actually sue and make a nuisance of themselves, you know, because local laws are blocking their ability to profit. Is,
yeah,
you know,
I mean, that's certainly, you know, that's certainly, you know, possible. Again, you know, the trickiest part with all this, Allison, and I don't mean to be difficult on this, but it's a fact is that to everything I'm talking about, I always have to say perhaps, right? Because as it stands, we, the public, do not have the negotiating text. So I don't know. I just spoke this past week in Washington at the, or what it early round, the fifth round, of a related trade agreement called the Transatlantic Trade and Investment Partnership, which is also known as a Transatlantic Free Trade Agreement, or CAFTA, or TTIP, okay? So that is a similar agreement to TPP, except this is being negotiated between the United States and the EU, right, the European Union. And so now, right, here, and this is in round five, whereas TPP has been around 20, there is no, in, there's no even real leaks. There's a position paper that's about two pages that was leaked, but there's nothing out there. And now you're dealing with, right, not this, you know, more, this trickier relationship building between countries, you know, like I said, like the U.S. and Malaysia that have not had these kinds of agreements. Now you're dealing with, of course, the bedrock of certainly the post World War II era, the, you know, the Atlantic Alliance, right, between the United States and Western Europe and then into Eastern Europe. So now you're dealing with not just all of these, and all of these issues that we talked about are potentially in this agreement as well, but now you're dealing with the geopolitical issues of, you know, a resurgent U.S.-European alliance that can deal with an emerging Russia and so forth. But here's the point, right? To the extent that the U.S. and the EU harmonize their laws in ways that make it more difficult, right, for fair uses to be made, that make it more easy for the entertainment industry to bring copyright infringement lawsuits against people that they think are infringing, even if they're not, right, to the extent that patent protection becomes stronger and gives more opportunities for patent owners to bring claims and therefore makes it more difficult for, let's say, again, generic medical manufacturers to create medicines that are cheaper and more widely accessible, you've got major problems getting to your environmental points, right? They go well beyond access to information. They go to health and safety. And so, for example, on the environmental side, right, it appears that hydraulic fracturing or fracking is an issue that could come up in the TTIP, the U.S.-EU agreement, because there appears to be a great interest in seeing that the United States and, in fact, Europe engage in fracking, right, to create more availability of natural gas to be a check against the need for European countries to get those kinds of resources from Russia and elsewhere. And so, again, here's the point, right? You've got this very blurry line between traditional trade issues and very non-traditional trade issues involving access to information and access to medicine, and they are all being run through a rubric that historically has not been very transparent.
In fact, it historically hasn't been very transparent, and it's so non-transparent that you don't know the provisions except through leaks, it sounds like, or shared documents. So, you know, the input from the public as to what this is and whether we want it or what component of it we want or we don't want, that discussion, I mean, how that isn't even able to happen. That's correct. Provisions revealed to the deliberative bodies? Are they able to see this information? And, you know, what if this gets passed and then later it turns out that there are highly problematic areas of it? You know, where is the opportunity to say we want this or, you know, we don't want this or we really need this to be more transparent? What's the timing of that? Where is the opportunity for public input?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So the answer right now. Let me give you the what I think is the U.S. Trade Representative's position on this issue to give you a framework. Right. So again, we're around 20 of TPP. The fifth round of TTIP has just been concluded. Right. And there has been no formal release of a negotiating text. And what's a negotiating text? The easiest way for your listeners to think about this is it's just like a bill in Congress, right? It is a proposed law, okay? Mm-hmm. In the absence of a formal release, with regard to, there have been, again, almost no, there's been no leak of even a text in TTIP because it's early, but in TTP, right, literally through WikiLeaks, we have had a couple of the more controversial chapters involving intellectual property and investment and so forth leaked. Now, what has happened is, as a result of public pressure, the U.S. Trade Representative has created in more recent rounds of TPP what they call a stakeholder input process. And what that is an opportunity for individuals and entities to apply to speak to the negotiators during the rounds. Okay, so I've applied speaking on my own capacity as an individual. And by the way, to be clear, anyone can do this, right? Apply, and you have the opportunity to give a very short, you know, in this last round of TTIP, it was 8 minutes, talk to whatever negotiators want to come to hear you speak. Now, in a sense, right, the USTR would say we are being transparent. We're being transparent because the public has the opportunity to do these talks. They say members of Congress have the opportunity to see the text, although that's not entirely clear. And in fact, Senator Wyden and in fact Representative Issa, to indicate that this is a bipartisan issue, have both criticized the Obama administration for failing to even make these texts available to members of Congress. Right, but there hasn't been much in the way of actual access to negotiating text. So what winds up happening is what my friend at Yale, Margo Kaminsky, calls transparency theater. And what that means is, and I've engaged in this theater, okay? Mm-hmm. You stand up in front of the negotiators, and you put up, in the case of TPP, a slide or slides that have the last leaked language that you can find. Now, the theatrical part of this, right, is that you as the public have no idea whether that text is current, right? You have no idea whether what you're speaking about, and again, you know, recognize that these are complex issues. You have people from Public Citizen and Knowledge Ecology International and you know, and organized labor and so forth, all coming to offer this input, you know, the broad civil society groups, not knowing whether, right, when they say, you know, paragraph 3, subsection A, should say this rather than that, whether this is even relevant anymore. For all we know, the negotiators have worked this out. They dropped the language. It's not an issue. But we have no idea.
And this is insane.
It is very
strange. I mean, is there anything like this? I've never even heard of such a thing.
No, and here's the kicker, Allison. No, there isn't. Because, again, to come back to, and I want to be fair here, because the USTR would say this is more transparent than we have been. And in that sense, they're right. Okay, they're right. Okay? But they also haven't been negotiating agreement that covers this wide a range of issues. Okay? Every member of the public who uses the internet has an interest in what TPP will look like. Because every one of us could wind up inadvertently running afoul of a copyright law that creates wide abilities for copyright owners to bring claims. Okay.
Unbelievable.
Some of your listeners may remember the anti-counterfeiting trade agreement, which was killed about 2 or 3 years ago now through public protests in Europe where people were wearing Guy Fawkes masks and so forth. ACTA, as it was known, was literally an attempt to get SOPA passed in a way through an international agreement. Okay? Even that agreement was more transparent. But every international trade body that exists, the World Trade Organization, the World Intellectual Property Organization, the UN, have been more transparent than this TPP and now TTIP negotiation. And now you might ask, well, what body is this being negotiated through? And there's the rub. There isn't one. They're making up the rules largely as they go along. And if to further make this complex, all of the negotiations are labeled national security of the United States, meaning they are labeled as information that cannot be revealed to the public because to reveal it would damage the national security of the United States by virtue of them being diplomatic negotiations. Okay? So the same rubric through which the United States would say, no, you, John Doe, cannot have our nuclear launch codes, which makes sense, right?
Yeah.
Is the same law that they would use to say, no, you, public citizens, okay? I didn't mean that, the organization, cannot have access to this information. At the same time, and as we sit here now, the entertainment industry through its lobbyists and the pharmaceutical industry through its lobbyists do have access to the negotiating text through an administrative process called the ITAX, the Industry Trade Advisory Council. Now, I'm going to stop here because I want to say this. If this sounds very complex, very procedural, very arcane, it is. And part of the reason why this is such a challenging issue to discuss is because it is so complex and so inside baseball that people literally glaze over. They say, I can't follow this. I don't know what's going on. And this is part of the problem. Because the USTR would say, and they have said, look, we need to negotiate with these countries, right, where we are trying to improve their law, right? We're trying to act in the U.S. best interest. We're trying to make the law better. And if we negotiate or try to negotiate these trade agreements publicly, we won't be able to conclude an agreement because there'll be public pressure and so forth. Right?
You know, I'm just going to interrupt you here because we're going to have to do a station identification. But, you know, the thing about this is that it's taking, you know, what we've seen with, for example, the labeling of food additives. These are areas of my beat. What we've seen with the labeling of GMOs, what we've seen with the identification of the contents of fracking fluids and chemicals, all kinds of things that are ingredients to which we are exposed, which pollute, which are disseminated, and which can impact people's health and impact the environment, impact other species, modify the food supply, all of those kinds of things. We've seen this trade secrets language used to hide the contents of things to which people are exposed. It sounds like this is taking it to an additional other level where the regulating laws themselves are secret until they're unveiled. This is, you know, a shocking and non-transparent process. We're going to have to take a break for station identification now on Progressive Radio Network, and we'll be coming back to talk more here on the Lifeboat Hour with David S. Levine. Law professor and expert on the Trans-Pacific Partnership will be taking questions in the second half of the show. Please, listeners, stay with us. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and stay with us for the second half of our discussion on the TPP here on the Lifeboat Hour. Okay, welcome back to the Lifeboat Hour. I'm Allison Rose Levy. I am here hosting tonight, substituting for Carolyn Baker, who's off at a conference, and we're talking about the Trans-Pacific Partnership, the PPP, with legal expert, law professor, blogger and thought leader on this, David S. Levine of Elon University. If you missed the first half hour of the show, please check it out in the Lifeboat Archives where you can find this. And also, quick aside, if you're interested in more talk on health, food, and the environment, you can tune into my regular weekly program, Connect the Dots, on Wednesday, 10 a.m. Eastern Time. We're going to take questions in the second half of the show for David Levine on this important topic, which he's been sharing with us. One of the ironies is the lack of transparency is such that this agreement is being negotiated without the public knowledge of exactly what's really being negotiated. So as we discuss the various areas that this trade agreement may touch, we're dealing with exposed documents, leaked documents, hypotheticals, and all the rest. I just, in the first half of our show, David mentioned several times a number of organizations that are actively exposing and trying to counter this overreaching agreement, which contains, as he said in the first half of the show, many, many provisions that are not really typically in trade agreements. And David, you mentioned Public Citizen. I just want to read this from their website. And also, Lifeboat listeners, this is a place where you can go to take action on this and stay updated on what's happening with the TPP at this crucial time when pressure on legislators and activism may be called for, if you feel so inclined. According to Public Citizen, they say that the TPP would even elevate individual foreign firms to equal status with sovereign nations, empowering them to privately enforce new rights and privileges provided by the pact by dragging governments to foreign tribunals to demand taxpayer compensation over policies that they claim undermine their expected future profits. That's really, I mean, this represents almost like a new world order, it sounds like. Is that overstating it, do you think, David?
You know, it's an interesting question, Allison. You know, I mean, I should say, and I want to say something quick about what you mentioned right before the break there. I mean, first, you know, my personal view, I'm not opposed to trade agreements. Mm-hmm. I'm opposed to secretly negotiated agreements that fail to include, in this case, the vast bulk of the people who will be directly impacted by it. And so, you know, I am more comfortable, not only from a democratic standpoint, but from a practical standpoint, in having a process that allows for input from a wide range of interests, right? And then letting the process sort it out, right? And we don't have that here. And because of that, right, and it's really too bad, you know, I couldn't possibly support a TPP agreement, and I can't envision that I would given the process. You know, I think Public Citizen's position is a little bit different than mine, in that I think they're more concerned about trade agreements generally, but we share this concern, and I've worked with people at Public Citizen who I have enormous regard for. With regard to the trade secret issue that you mentioned, and this is a topic worthy of another hour, so I'll make this one very simple as well. Trade secrecy, by definition, prevents access to information by virtue of it being commercially valuable if it's a secret. And you are absolutely right that the trade secrecy issues in these agreements, which are now starting to get more prominence and be pushed harder because, obviously, of the issues that have brought before, not only with regard to Chinese espionage, but, of course, the flip side now with regard to what we know about the North and think we know about the NSA's behavior and their undermining of our confidence in our internet infrastructure, also raises the issue from our negotiating partners that you too might be trying to go after our trade secrets in ways that are illegal. But you're absolutely right. By way of disclosure, I have both written on trade secrecy and fracking heavily. I'm also a member of the North Carolina Mining and Energy Commission's Trade Secret Study Group, where I am advising and attempting to advise the commissioners on issues involving trade secrecy and fracking, because I am extremely concerned that trade secrecy is being used in a way that prevents the public from knowing exactly what the fracking industry is doing with our natural resources, right? And so the environmental health and safety issues that are potentially raised by fracking cannot be adequately not only regulated, but analyzed, because the formula of the chemicals going into the ground are claimed to be trade secrets by Halliburton and the other chemical companies. And again, here's the kicker. They probably are. And that's because our law is a mess, okay? A trade secret law is not built to balance interests of the public in getting access to trade secrets. To the extent, and this is something I should tell you that I'm really starting to focus on heavily now, because it hasn't really been a big issue until more recently, particularly, again, as fracking is bringing this issue to the international arena, I'm very concerned that if we're going to export a very strict trade secret law to other countries that don't have a well-developed law, we could wind up exporting what I think is a extremely restrictive and damaging trade secret law, that while it is valuable for industry, and I'm not opposed to trade secret, it has no method and no built-in way to assess whether the commercial interest in the trade secret should be outweighed by the public's interest in the information. And so my view on fracking has been, and I've said this publicly, and I've said this in meetings of the Mining and Energy Commission, if the benefits outweigh the costs, then I'm pro-fracking. And if the costs outweigh the benefits, then I'm anti-fracking. But we cannot do that assessment so long as Halliburton takes the position that the formula, the exact composition, right, and percentages of chemicals are trade secrets, where they get to decide, and only they get to decide, whether this is safe. That to me is untenable. That to me is anti-democratic. And that's not what the law should allow, even though it does.
I'm completely with you on that one, having broken the story on fracking on the Huffington Post and followed it for the last 6 years or so, and there's all kinds of reasons. I've done numerous shows on this where, you know, people literally are exposed to chemicals from fracking, develop ailments and symptoms that are very across the board. We know that the stuff migrates into water supplies and can travel through air and elsewhere, and yet when people are you know, manifest these symptoms, they can't be treated, and the doctors themselves don't know what's in these things. Let's open the lines to callers. Please share your questions with David Levine, speaking with us today about the Trans-Pacific Partnership and other trade agreements ongoing right now, being negotiated without full transparency. That's putting it mildly. Please, if you have any questions, call in, and we'll take some calls. While people are getting to the phones and everything, David, if there are interested callers, It's like, what can people do? Is there was an initial move to fast track, what's called fast track, just push these through without, you know, just saying, oh, come on, guys, let's rubber stamp this, let's pass it, and then we'll see. But there was a fairly massive outcry about that. What is the status of the attempts to fast track at this point in time?
Yeah, that's a great question too. This is a certain amount of crystal ball gazing, Allison, as you know. And so, you know, I don't hold me to this, but as it stands now, it appears that fast track seem to have been all but killed because of concerns about transparency and what have you. More recently, however, and this is literally within the last week or two, my sense is that perhaps there's a renewed effort to attempt to move fast track forward. And again, for your listeners that don't follow this, what fast track is, and this is all procedural stuff, but you know, as Larry Lessig, for whom I have worked and have enormous fondness for, he's been a mentor and friend, has said with regard to campaign finance reform, it's not that these issues are the most important, but they're the first issues you have to address. In other words, in case of campaign finance, you cannot get to the substantive problems in the law if you don't first address the campaign finance system. So, too, you can't get to the substance of these trade agreements without first fixing the procedure. Fast track authority would basically speed along the trade agreement and make it much more difficult for the public ultimately to be able to have a say right through it through their representatives to change the agreement. As it stands now, it appears fast track may have some resurgence. And so to answer your question as to what people can do, I'll have a couple of suggestions. And this, again, part of it will depend on your perspective on all these things. Like, in other words, whether you just think trade agreements are a problem generally or whether you're concerned about the process or what have you. But I'll make a couple of general suggestions. First, as I said earlier, Public Citizen has done terrific work. They have a number of great people who are experts in various areas here, starting with, you know, Rob Weissman, who I heard speak at TTIP last week, but also, you know, staffers and others who have been around these issues for years. And so I would suggest, you know, literally checking out their webpage and subscribing to their feed. I also would suggest that whether you're on, if you use Facebook, you can do this or otherwise, but subscribe or like Senator Wyden from Oregon, because Senator Wyden has done incredible work trying to push the Obama administration to open up this process. And so I recommend his work. I recommend what he has done. He's been incredible.
It's good to know. We have a caller on the line.
The other I would mention, yeah.
Okay, great. We have a caller on the line. Tim is on the line calling from Florida, and he has a question about the law issues that we're discussing today. Tim, are you there? Hi.
Yeah, sure I am.
Go ahead.
Go ahead?
Yep.
Okay, I was just wondering if we don't know what the laws are, how are we going to know if and when we break a law and what the punishments are? I mean, the punishments could be, you know, it's just very arbitrary. It reminds me of some of Glenn Greenwald's stories about the violation of law, and then you just get thrown into a dungeon or a jail or somewhere, or you just disappear. And
that's an excellent
question.
The
whole world is kind of moving in that direction.
Well, it's a very good question. How can, if we don't know, is the idea, David, that ultimately these laws get revealed, or are they going to be kind of unfolding in a way where people are violating laws that they didn't even know they violated?
So Tim, thanks for the question. And no, I mean, eventually, right, if this actually came to fruition, we would know what the rules are. Now, the tricky part, of course, would be we may not know what the rules are, but we may not know how they're interpreted. We may not know how they'll be enforced, right? And as you mentioned earlier, Allison, right, quoting Public Citizen, right, to the extent that private entities will have the ability to act in this quasi-judicial role, that can be a major problem. You know, in SOPA and PIPA, one of the major reasons why I and many other intellectual property professors and others from all political stripes, by the way, post SOPA and PIPA, is that it was unclear that people would even get notice. In other words, they would find out that an action had been brought against them in U.S. courts under SOPA and PIPA. So those kinds of issues do raise the question of notice. As far as the rules go, and again, to be clear, so that because I want to not only be accurate, but not raise concerns that don't exist, TPP is not the law as it stands today. It's still being negotiated. TTIP is not the law. But no, it, while we will eventually theoretically know what these rules are, we won't know how they will be enforced. And, if you're in a country that's a signatory partner, of course, you'll be dealing with their process.
It would be just weird. It seems like you would just show up in court somewhere and you don't know what's going to happen to you. They're going to take your assets or if there's going to be some other civil penalty or what.
Well, Tim, and the kicker here is that, when it comes to law enforcement, right, there are legal actions where you're actually in court trying to force the law, right, or force your rights.
Mm-hmm.
And then there are threats, right? And the threats to bring a lawsuit, right, what in the intellectual property is known as a cease and desist letter, right, the letter that's sent by a copyright owner that says, we think you are violating our copyright, right? And
mm-hmm.
you, right, can either stop what you're doing or prepare to get sued. That alone can wind up being a very effective tactic, right? If you are an individual who puts a video up on YouTube and you get a letter, right, from a large entertainment industry company, right, that says something like that from their lawyers, you're more likely not to say, I don't have the resources to fight this, and I can't, right, even if you, in fact, have a valid defense. So through the Center for Internet Society at Stanford, when I was there, and it's still going, they developed the Fair Use Project. And the Fair Use Project was designed precisely to help documentary filmmakers deal with these kinds of issues. So the issue is not just what happens in tribunals and in courts, but what rights it gives copyright holders, pharmaceutical industry, and so forth, to send these kinds of letters and effectively, right, to be clear, if the claim doesn't have merit, bully people, right, or entities into doing what they want.
Yeah, I was going to ask you about entities because it sounds like the world is already at war as it is. It's as if they could do this to one another, corporation to corporation, to keep them from proceeding with something that they would want to do, that the competitor wouldn't want them to do.
Well, this is the issue. Yeah, I mean, this is the issue that on the patent side that's come up recently in this country with these battle over patent trolls or non-practicing entities or patent assertion entities, these entities that acquire patent portfolios solely for the purpose of bringing actions against other entities that they claim are violating their patents. And this is also a very complex issue because it raises issues of why these patents are being issued in the first place. But yes, I mean, as Allison read from Public Citizen, and they're right, to the extent, and we don't know, but to the extent that private entities are going to get these kinds of powers of enforcement, well, we are dealing with, and to answer your question, Allison, from earlier, a new world order. I mean, that's, that phrase is, used a lot of different ways, but certainly that would be an escalation of the ability of corporate entities to enforce their rights.
Mm. Well, I
just want to interject something here too, which is, the what you're describing also has an extremely chilling effect on the freedom of the press, which we already know is highly commercialized and, subject to pressure and persuasion and various agendas. The internet, it becomes a problem to share, to say, to speak, to, it seems like it would have an incredibly chilling effect on things, communications across the board, really, just to create a battleground around these issues, it would seem to me. I mean, can you project, I know, because you do work in the in this area, I mean, what would be some of the further ramifications? I mean, would the kinds of discussions, sharings, programs like this one, will people feel as free if there is a climate of dispute and competition interjected into what has been, a pretty open conversation? And how does this interact with issues like net neutrality? I know that's not your specific area, and we're coming near the end of the program, but I'd just love to hear a comment from you, David, about that.
Yeah, well, I mean, I've written on net neutrality a bit, and I, mm-hmm. Like I said, my affiliation with CIS and a lot of work I've done is on internet policy. And yes, I mean, that is a concern. I come at this entire issue from a firm belief that society improves with access to information. Mm-hmm. The old saying that the truth will out, and despite all of the broken processes we have, and I am a firm supporter in what Professor Lessig is doing with regard to campaign finance. And if your listeners aren't familiar with it, I urge you to check out his Root Strikers website and the work that he's doing, which is incredible, to try to get at the campaign finance issue, which is a huge problem. But a related issue, and one that I think is equally important, is access to good information. Right, and whether it's the war on science that seems to exist with regard to climate change, whether it's the ability of corporations to decide what the public should know about fracking, whether it's the ability of corporations through trade secrecy to argue that how voting machines work shouldn't be public because they're trade secrets, I'm very concerned that commercial policy, that commercial law has become too powerful. It's become too much of a check against access information. And, of course, you know, it's true that we all know, right, the greatest, you know, medium for exchange of information is the Internet. So I am a firm supporter of protecting the Internet as an infrastructure that allows for the free flow of information, which gets us to the net neutrality issue, right? Mm-hmm. To the extent that net neutrality means that Comcast, right, or Disney, or name again the entity, right, is able or not able to charge more to entities that can pay more to have their traffic move more quickly. I'm very concerned that public citizen could wind up having their traffic not just slow down, meaning people don't get to it, right, or don't get to it as quickly, but potentially, right, shut off to some degree, right, because Disney can pay more, okay? And that, again, gets to the Internet as an infrastructure. To the extent that TPP, right, moves U.S. copyright law, right, our interminable copyright duration, where right now copyrights last well beyond the life of the author, okay, work mm-hmm. that Professor Lessig did with Eldred, to the extent that it moves the bad provisions of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act that, again, as I was mentioning earlier, could make it very difficult to engage in fair uses, to the extent that you're going to increase damage awards and penalties, those issues all could wind up putting someone in a position of saying, you know what, I was going to blog this, or I was going to write this, or I was going to say this, but I'm not going to say it because I can't run the risk of being sued by X, Y, or Z or having those hassles. And so that's a huge issue. On the patent side, right, to the extent that patent protection is improved or strengthened such that medicines don't become generic, right, and but again, to be clear for those that, you know, don't follow what I'm saying, right, when you have a patent term, right, which is needed, again, to be clear, I'm not opposed to intellectual property law either. You have to give the pharmaceutical industry the opportunity to recoup, right, the research and development costs that they put in developing medicine. But there's a limit to that, right? Eventually, the deal is you get a monopoly as a patent, meaning you own the patent, you're the only one who can make it, but after a period of time, that patent disappears. And then anyone can come in and copy it. And that's how generic medicines, right, make it into countries where people can't pay $900 a month for the medicine, right, but they could pay $10. Okay, but if you're going to increase patent protection, you literally limit the ability of people in people with resources like that in countries like that from getting life-saving medicines. And as dramatic as that sounds, it is all in the TPP, right? With regard to fracking, I mean, with trade secrecy, we don't know what chemicals are down there. We have to trust that Halliburton, what they tell us it's safe, right, is correct. That's a problem, too. On the flip side, and here's one to think about, right, as you think about some challenges here, right, what if you have a company that says we have a safer way, right, to engage in fracking, but we need trade secret protection in order to do that testing because we need to know that if we invest the time, we're going to be able to make money off of it. So if you, state, don't give us trade secret protection, we'll go somewhere else that will, or we won't develop it. That's also a legitimate concern, right? So to the extent that intellectual property law is actually moving companies and innovators in the directions we want them to go, we have to take that seriously too. So it's not as simple as saying no trade secrets at all, but it's also not clearly should be the case that we say all trade secrets.
Well, these, you know, I thank you, David. This has been terrific to really parse both where the balance points of a constructive and useful compromise between different sides on these issues might lie, and the place where we've kind of tipped over into imbalance further, unfortunately, and created tremendous problems for ourselves. And we've discussed a number of complex issues on today's show, and you've really been incredibly helpful. And thank you on behalf of our listeners and myself, you know, for really clarifying so much about the TPP with us. Where can our listeners find you if they want to follow your blogs and hear more and read more about what you are offering?
Sure. So a couple of places you can go for my writings here. The first is infojustice.org. That's I-N-F-O, the word justice.org. That is the blog that American University's Project on Information Justice and Intellectual Property operates. They do wonderful work. Sean Flynn and others there, I highly recommend their work, because they, American University, more than any other school in the country, has focused on international law issues, and I've done a lot of work with them, and I have huge regard. So infojustice.org, I've blogged there and written there. You can also check the blog at the Center for Internet and Society at Stanford Law School. That's cyberlaw.stanford.edu, where I've also blogged. And then if you really want to get in the weeds, and if, you know, again, I recognize how complex these issues are, not that they can't be understood, but they are very complex, you can go to the webpage where I have my academic writing, and that's at the Social Science Research Network, or SSRN.com, and you'll simply search my name, and you'll hit this stuff. But again,
thank you so much, David. We're coming down to the end of the show, and it's just been terrific. You've certainly given us a lot to think about here on the Lifeboat Hour. Thank you so much for being with us, and thank you, listeners, for being with us tonight on the Lifeboat Hour. I'm Allison Rose Levy. It's been a pleasure hosting the show. Next week, Carolyn Baker will be back with you again as the show host that she is in returning from her conference, and I want to send a shout-out to Carolyn as well for this wonderful honor of hosting this terrific program. If you'd like to hear more of my reporting, you can find me on Alternet and the Huffington Post, as well as on Connect the Dots here on PRN. Have a great week, everyone, and Carolyn will be back next week.
Old Black Joe's still picking cotton for your ribbons and bows.